What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Zach and Pat Show. I'm Zach.
I'm Pat.
This is the show about manhood, fatherhood, entrepreneurship, and the mentality it takes to be successful at those things. And we'll probably sprinkle in some helpful real estate advice, too, because that's what Pat and I do. You know, guys, life can be tough, go through some things, and struggle at times, but this is the show to let you know that you're not alone. So if you're someone out there going through any of these things, this is the show for you.
All right, guys, let's talk about something we all need. High quality, comfortable, stylish clothing that actually holds up in real life. Whether you're grinding at work, hitting the gym, or just hanging out, the Normal brand has you covered. I've been rocking their gear, and let me tell you, it's not your average clothing line. They've nailed it perfect with the perfect blend of durability, comfort, style. Whether it's a go-to rugged Henley, a hoodie, a button-down that doesn't make you feel like a stiff, the Normal brand is where it's at. The best part is you can support the show while upgrading your wardrobe. Just hit the link in the description below. Check out their collection. Trust me, once you try it, you'll wonder why you didn't do it sooner. The Normal brand. Made for real life, built to last. Now go check them out.
Shout out to our friends over at Captain Beard Co. Guys, if you are looking for beard care products, shampoo, conditioner, body wash, give Captain Beard Co. a try. They have this unbelievable beard butter, balm, oils, and then it smells amazing. Ladies, if you're looking for something for your men as a gift to help with their grooming, check them out. Also, if you guys are looking to just set the mood one night, candles, unbelievably smelling candles, made with all natural ingredients here locally to St. Louis. Give them a shot. Also, while you're there, use the promo code Zach and Pat for 10% off your purchase.
Hey there, guys. Really appreciate you checking out the Zach and Pat Show. If you can obviously tell, we are a newer podcast, but one way we're really trying to grow the show is trying to get up the amount of subscribers we have. So, you know, if you're watching the show and you're getting something out of it, we'd really appreciate it if you could click that subscribe button. That would help us out a ton. Please click that button. And now back to the show.
We have a very special guest in studio today, the great and powerful Reed Lowe.
Welcome.
Welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Dude,
Thanks for having me.
I've been really looking forward to this one. So to have a former Blues hockey player in here, you know, Pat and I are both hockey fans. Pat's a huge hockey fan. Oh, yeah. I'm a, you know, more of a casual myself. I grew up playing a little bit. Pat played a lot growing up. But yeah, so I love to get into, you know, your career and kind of after hockey. For those of you guys, or for the people out there that don't know you, give kind of people a little rundown of who is Reed Lowe.
Well, I was born and raised in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. And if Jim Campbell, my other Blues alumni brother, was sitting beside me, he'd be like, "Where's Moose Jaw?" And then I would say 6 feet from a moose's ass, and everybody would laugh. And that's the joke that we play all the time. Just grew up loving hockey. If I wasn't, you know, on the rink in organized hockey, I was either playing street hockey or, you know, we had outdoor rinks back where I'm from. So that's all it was for me from the day I was, you know, in the fourth grade. It says I'm going to make the NHL in my yearbook, and everybody used to laugh at me. And then lo and behold, somewhere down the line, I got lucky enough and worked hard enough, and all the stars aligned, and I managed to not only make the NHL, but, you know, have a significant career, 5.5 years in the NHL, over 250 games. So sometimes I look back on it and I pinch myself, but I tell people a lot, like, you know, hockey's just something I did. You know, I hope that, you know, I don't know if you guys ever read the poem, The Dash, but it's basically about your death year, your birth year, and your death year. And then there's that little dash in between. And, you know, if I make it 75, 80 years old, I hope that 5.5 years isn't the only thing that is what I am. You know, it's obviously a huge part of why I live in St. Louis and what has kind of grown me to where I'm at today. But, you know, been through a lot, and my NHL career is something I'm proud of. But if we sat in a room and nobody knew who I was, we would never talk about it. So it's not who defines me and not what defines me. But at the same time, I'm proud of it. And I know that there's a lot of people that want to discuss it and know about it and hear stories and whatever else. So I'm just hockey through and through ever since I was a little kid. Grew up, my mom, everyone says that I got spit out of the womb with hockey skates on. So that's awesome.
I love it, man. That's awesome. So you were kind of enforcer, the enforcer in the Blues, yeah, right? Back at the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's a whole different level of crazy.
Yeah.
What's it like, you know, kind of being the guy that, you know, is known to throw down?
Well, it wasn't always like that. You know, the one thing I think that I take away when I look at today and how parents, we were just talking before the show, how parents are so crazy in all sports, especially today with private lessons and everything that goes on. You know, I only played 3 years of tier one hockey before I signed an NHL contract. once when I was 13, and then I played 2 years as a 19 and a 20-year-old in the Western Hockey League. And so I always tell people and these parents, I'm like, it doesn't matter where your kid's playing when they're 10 years old. Teach them three things, you know, how to be a great teammate, how to be coachable, and how to outwork the guy across from you. Like, those are really the only things we truly have control over. So as I grew up, those were the things that my dad instilled with me, and I got cut from so many different hockey teams. Like, and I wanted to make the top team. I just was just that step behind. And my dad's like, listen, bud, like, you're going to be on the power play on the lower level. You're going to get more ice time. If you're on the upper level, you'd probably be on the bench most of the time and you wouldn't be developing as much. And so what seemed to be the worst thing ever ended up being probably a blessing in my life. And I, you know, was a top scorer on my team when I was in midget double A. And then I went and tried out for a junior team in the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey League and had a really good training camp, and I scored 4 goals in the inter squad game, and the coach put me against the 2 other tough guys that were in camp, and I beat the crap out of both of them. And, you know, I went into the coach's office after, and he said, do you think you can do that again? And I said, score 4 goals in a game? And he said, no, beat the hell out of somebody. I'm like, well, does it mean I'm going to make the team? He's like, yeah. I'm like, well, you point him out and I'll take him out. And literally that year, he'd be like, go get number 2, go get number 6. And so I learned how to kind of be a tough guy at that moment. And, you know, I ended up, couple 3 years later, I was 17 at that point in time. And so it just kind of grew from there. And the next thing you know, I'm in the Western Hockey League, which is the best junior hockey world in the world. And I'm fighting. The stats are on hockeyfights.com. We look this stuff up all the time, like with my kids and that. And I had 73 fights in 123 junior games. So I was a little bit of an animal. And I've never been in a street fight, never been in a bar fight. I'm not a fighter. I just wanted to fight more than I didn't want to make the NHL. So I'm like, if this is my only way that I'm going to get there, then I'm ready to do whatever I got to do because I want that so badly. So that is the real reason why I was the enforcer and why I wanted to be in the enforcer. But fighting is not something that I love to do. Yeah. Now, if you were watching YouTube, you'd be like, come on, man. Come on. Put a pair of hockey skates on me. Yeah, put a pair of hockey skates on me, and I wanted to beat the hell out of you, no question. Yeah, but I knew that I had to, you know, it's do or die, right? Like, it's either your face or mine, and I'm going to take yours.
Yeah. Well, and then that, too, and it's that's what they're bringing you up as an enforcer, and everybody's got a role on a team. And you saw it, like, I saw in baseball, like, guys would come and get drafted as a position player and they wouldn't want to give that up. So they would switch to a pitcher and try and become a pitcher and see if they can make it that way. Sometimes it works. Rick Ankiel was a reverse example of that, but you do see it happen quite frequently. Jason Mott with the Cardinals, he was a catcher coming up through the minor leagues and they turned him into a pitcher. So guys are really like wanting, once you get to that level and they're dangling that carrot in front of your face, like, hey, you can get there. You're going to do whatever it takes to get there.
100%.
And so, I mean, I can understand why it's like, yeah, I don't want to fight, but hell, this is what's going to get me to the NHL and I'm going to do it.
And the same thing on the reverse side, there's a lot of players that grow up that are the best in the team and they get to that point in their life and, you know, take a bad penalty or, you know, whatever sport you're playing, it doesn't matter, but you never really lived through the adversities that I had to live through. So when the adversities came to me and they were in front of me when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, all the way up till I retired from hockey, I understood how to battle through them and accept them, where a lot of these kids, they get drafted in the first round, they're 50 goal scorers in junior hockey, they're a first round draft pick and they're in the minors and they're not going to be a 50 goal scorer, not even the minors, and yet they want to try and do it at the NHL level, because every time you make another level, the it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and there's not going to be as many junior 50 goal scorers as there is in the NHL. So are you able to work on your game, change things up, battle through the adversity, suck it up, and make that next level? You see guys do it. That's why there's guys that are first round draft picks that never make the NHL, and there's guys that are undrafted that play 1,000 games and win 3 Stanley Cups.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I know on baseball, I'm not sure what the stat is on hockey, but I know that there's way more lower level or lower draft picks that make it to the big leagues just because they're, like you said, the adversity.
Yeah.
I mean, trying to adapt and get, you know, and they just improve and they work hard and they get there.
Yeah.
Now, granted, the high draft picks, you know, they got the money in them, so they're going to push them that way. But,
and there's been, you know, look at the NFL, how many quarterbacks get drafted in the first round, the top 10, and they end up being just complete bust. And I think it's a little bit more dramatic at the NFL level because there's not a whole lot of places for people to go play after. after. And I, that's one thing that I love about the XFL is that it gives guys an opportunity to go still play the game if they don't make it and have an opportunity to play in the NFL. And obviously there's the CFL in Canada, but it's a little different because the rules are different up there. But the preliminary, like, it's basically the same thing with some different downs and some different field options and whatever else. But it's not easy. I look back at it still today and go, wow, did I really do that? You know, but it's cool.
What, so you obviously been in a ton of fights on the ice. Do you have one, is there one that like sticks out from you, sticks out like a big hit, big like punch you took or,
you know, the shit out of me.
Yeah, one that you beat the shit out of somebody or is there like a,
you know, there's and I've been in over 300 plus 320, 330 ice fights in 17 years. So
that's,
it's
nuts.
You know, I think I had like 110 NHL fights and I had probably another, at least that in the minor leagues, plus, you know, everything that I did, you know, growing up and whatever else. But, you know, I fought Bob Probert and, you know, Bob Probert's a legend. You know, he'll go down as one of the toughest guys, if not craziest guys for sure. He was feared. You know, I fought Twister, which was fun, but he just slapped me around a little bit in training camp, so it wasn't a real fight. He just had to let me know who Boss was. And, you know, but one of my, probably my two favorite fights that I have, and I really couldn't pick one because they're both real fun. And one of them is one of the most hit fights on YouTube, and it's me and PJ Stock. And we literally, there had to have been 100 punches thrown between the two of us. Like, it was just, we like right off the bat, it's just toe to toe, his lefts versus my rights. And we're just chucking them at each other. Then we're switching up. And then I hit him with a couple uppercuts at the end of the fight, which I believe give me the decision. But there's 14 minutes left in the third period. It's a 2-2 hockey game. We're in Boston Saturday afternoon at the Gardens. And I'm like, bro, we're not going to get another shift. I'm like, you want to put a show on for the fans? And we'd already fought probably 10 times. And he's a little guy, pound for pound, one of the toughest guys in hockey ever, for sure in my eras. He's 5'10", maybe 215 pounds. I was 6'4", 225, and he fought everybody. And so we went after it, and then we went to the bar after because Billy Guerin was on the Bruins, and Big Walt, Keith Tkachuk, and Dougie Waite were really good friends because they're all USA hockey guys. And so we went to this bar after, and so me and PJ Stock were hanging out at the bar taking pictures. We both had shiners. And then the other one is real good is, you know, Scott Parker. He's a big, tough guy. Played for Colorado for a long time, San Jose Sharks. And he always used to beat the hell out of me, but this one night he was roughing up Al MacInnis. And I always tell people, like, I was really, like, there's times where you just have to flip a switch and fight a guy to see who's tougher. But there's times when I'm out there protecting, and I was always very, very, like, a lot tougher in my opinion than when I was protecting somebody, because it just was a different animal inside of me that was pissed off. Like, now you mess with one of my boys and I'm going to crush your face. And so we had another really good tilt, and I also scored my first NHL goal that night on Patrick Waugh, one of the most legendary goalies of all time. And I did all that on my dad's birthday. So that was a pretty special night for my family.
That's, dude, awesome.
That's cool. How often are you like, or when, you know, whenever you're going to fight somebody, like, is it always like, if you had to like say a percentage of the time, like, how often do you guys, like, you know, lined up against each other? Like, you want to put on a show, or how often would it be like something where, hey, I want to go fuck this dude up because he hurt one of my boys?
I would say that if I were to get in 20 fights, 15 of them are like, let's just get after it. And then five are, I'm going out there to get some retribution.
Got it. Okay.
So a lot of fights at the beginning of the season, we're just kind of jostling to see who's tougher. And one of the main reasons, I think, for me, why I did it, and I can't speak for anybody else, but why I was so engaged in the fights at the beginning of the season was I wanted to establish a presence for my hockey team. And the team that I was on and the teammates that I had. And, you know, I was the toughest guy in the team. Everybody knew it. I knew it. I knew it was my role. I played my role to the best of my abilities. There was times where I struggled with it just because it can get in your head a little bit as well. So it was never perfect at it, but I believe that the want, need, and desire was always there for me. But I wanted everyone on my team to be a couple inches taller and 20 pounds heavier. And if I was on the bench, I wanted the other team to know, listen, you know, you fuck around and find out, and you could come messing with my guys, I'm coming to get you. So I feel like if you ever talked to any of my teammates, hopefully that's how they felt about me. And, cause I took pride in it, and it really stems back to, you know, not being very popular as a young kid from the time I was 10 till I was probably 13 or 14. I had really bad bouts of depression as a young kid. I didn't have a lot of friends. And then as I started to move through hockey and I found this role as an enforcer and people started liking me more. And now I had a purpose where they're like, well, we got Losey and he's our guy. Right. And now I fit in finally somewhere. And I think that's why I chased that role so much, because I'd lived through times where I didn't have any friends. And now I'd found something that really guys didn't want to do it. Right. Like there's not a lot of guys who are like, oh, sure, I'll take the punches in the face rather than score the goals. Right. Yeah. But I was like, if that's what it takes for me to kind of fit in life, that's what it really was for me at 17 years of age. Cause I was just looking for a place to fit.
Incredible. So now like the way the game's played today, I mean, you don't really see too many enforcers anymore. The Blues, I feel like, just having been a hockey fan growing up, the Blues have always had a pretty strong enforcer on their team. I mean, how do you see it in today's game? I mean, it's just kind of a position that's kind of just kind of faded away a little bit?
You know,
bit?
I think that the biggest challenge that the NHL and I guess just the hockey fans are facing right now is that junior hockey at some levels have really restricted what they allow guys to do from a fighting standpoint. When I was in the league in the NHL, they were already starting to say, hey, listen, like we're up 4 goals. Don't fight their other guy. We're in the 80s and 90s, it was like, okay, listen, if one team got up 4-0 and the game started to get a little chippy, the two tough guys that signed the dotted line, that this is their role, went out there, beat the hell out of each other, and then a good game usually ensued, and a good hockey game usually came from it. They started changing that in the late 90s, early 2000s, and into the late 2000s, and almost have kind of eliminated that role of having an enforcer. You know, we still have some enforcers, but today more than ever, that enforcer has to be able to play the game. You have to be able to contribute. And you can't afford to have a guy that's just tough on the bench that's a liability while he's on the ice, because the games are too tight. The hockey players are too good nowadays. These kids are training at the highest level ever. And you see it. You just look at a guy like Connor McDavid, how fast he is, and what that guy does with the puck on his stick at such a high speed is just absolutely incredible. And he's not the only one. Nathan McKinnon's no different. Sidney Crosby, you know, are these guys better than Gretzky or Lemieux? I don't think so. Will they ever get those points? No. But was the game different back then? Yeah, it was. They didn't watch video back then. They drank beer and smoked cigarettes after the game, not get protein shakes and go for, you know, a warm down workout. And then, you know what I mean? Like, it's a completely different world today. So, like Michael Jordan always says, he never wants to be said that he's the greatest, even though we all know that he is. Because there's so many different generations. There's the past and there's the guys that were after him. So I feel the same way in hockey. Although, you know, Gretzky has more assists than any other player has points, it's pretty easy to trigger him as a guy that really did it right. But, you know, the enforcer role is a little bit lost, but it's never going to stop fighting in the game of hockey. And now you see guys like Braden Schenn, who's a $7 million a year guy. He's kind of the guy that fights when we have to, even though they got Tucker, who'll step in there and get after it. You know, you saw it, Colton Pranko in Four Nations getting a fight with JT Miller. I'd love to see him fight a couple times. If I was Pranko's coach, I would tell him this.
Play like Pronger.
You can't play like Pronger because you'd be in jail, okay? You would not just be in the penalty box. They'd escort you to jail. But a little bit of that Pronger, yeah, that's what we need. And I would just tell him, like, if there was a moment where somebody crashed the net and got a little aggressive, I don't care how many penalty minutes you take, we'll kill it off, figure it out, drop your gloves 3 times in the first 20 games and just absolutely beat the brakes off somebody. And guys are going to have a different image of going to the net while you're in front of it. If they know that there's just a chance, right? If they know there's not a chance, then they're not scared of you. They're like, whatever, you big baby, you know? And he's played tough for the last 2 years. And I don't know if he's just kind of growing into it, but really too bad that he hurt himself, because I really felt like he's having his best season all the way around, had 15 goals, I think, already. Like he was in, they're talking about running for Norris Trophy winning, and he's playing physical. He's jumping in the play. This is by far his best year. And hopefully that knee's not too bad, because he's really coming into his own at 28, 29 years old.
That's awesome. Now, do you still have a lot of do you go to the practices and stuff like that with the Blue? Any sort of like consulting or talking with any of those guys?
No, it's
more of the alumni side of stuff.
Yeah, we do all of our alumni stuff. I stay away. You know, I had my time there. You know, if they, you know, Mike Crusoe asked me to do some fun stuff, commercial type stuff. I did a thing, me and Cam Jansen did a thing at this antique store for the old games that they were playing, I think on Channel 11 or Channel 4 or whatever it was. So we've done some fun stuff like that. I'm always willing to engage back, be a part of the city. I'm proud to be a Blues alumni. I'm proud to have wore the note. I'm proud to consider St. Louis my home, where I'm going to live for the rest of my life and raise my family here and coach hockey and all the things that have come along with it. But, you know, I just let those guys do their own thing. If they need me, they'll let me know.
See, that's awesome. And that's another thing that you mentioned that I've noticed, and it's not just hockey players, but baseball players as well, because that was more of the world that I was in. But you see a lot of guys that come here and establish a career and all that and then stay.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think it is about St. Louis that causes people to just want to stay?
It's just a great town. Yeah. And that being said, with how shitty our downtown is, it's sad because we could have little Nashville here if the government down there would get their head out of their ass and realize that they don't have to tax the people down there, that they could have tourism taxes and bring some people down there with some money to really build that up and get the landing going again and get some real cool stuff going down there. But other than that not being right, look at how we have everything else that's so good in this town. Soccer's awesome. We've got three amazing sports teams. And really at the end of the day, it just comes down to the fans. And I can't speak for the baseball players because I know a lot of the baseball players stick around too. And obviously St. Louis is one of the most old school baseball communities in probably the entire league. But what makes St. Louis special for the St. Louis Blues fans is what I call the Bobby Plager way. And Bobby and Barkley were so ingrained themselves so much in this community in the 70s, early 70s, you know, once they had retired from hockey and then started to get into working with the organization. But not just that, if you go to like the Afton rink, there's pictures on the wall of these guys on tractors helping them build that rink back in the day. So they not only were a part of it and helped raise the money for it, but they actually got dirty and got into the construction aspect of it too. And when I saw those pictures up there and somebody was telling me the story that those guys were actually helping build the rink, I was like, man, that's incredible. Awesome. And they just paved the way for the rest of us to want to be here. And it's a little different today. Although when you talk to some of the alumni, there's some of these guys the last 4 or 5 years that are looking for a way to come back to St. Louis. It was a little different in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s because guys never made the money that they were making now. So there was an opportunity for different organizations and companies to say, listen, stick around. We'll give you a job. Mm-hmm. Like we'll figure something out for you. And so guys had an opportunity to work and be a part of the community and were welcomed into the community. And I tell people all the time, listen, what high school did you go to? All the stuff. St. Louis is not an easy community to infiltrate if you're an outsider. You know what I mean? You know, if you're from Columbus and you just decided to move to St. Louis, it's not easy. But when you give your blood, sweat, and tears to this community and you show them that you want to be a part of it, they're just very endearing and they love it. And so why would we not want to stick around? I've been retired from the game for 18 years and man, people walk up to me and they're like, man, it seems like 4 or 5 years ago. Right. And so it blows by, but it's the community. 100% is a community that we want to be a part of and they want us to be a part of it.
That's awesome.
So cool, man. So, well, you're an auctioneer now. How did that come about?
I'm a third generation auctioneer. My dad and my grandfather, both auctioneers, actually my uncle as well. So when I retired from hockey, I got right into real estate because my dad was a real estate agent for most of my life. He was an auctioneer back in the day when I was younger. So I got into real estate and I got a lead for, this big auction company, industrial construction auction company called Ritchie Brothers Auctioneers that were coming to St. Louis and they were looking to build a facility here. And so I start kind of moving along the way and literally 4 months later, they offered me a job and I end up working for them for 9 years. And while we were doing that, I was a salesman that would either bring people or bring equipment to the auction or both because we would sell all the equipment unreserved that day, highest bidder, regardless of price. And while I was doing it, I had to learn how to catch bids. So while it's at $27.50 and I'd tell the auctioneer, yep, then in 3,000, now $32.50. And I'd have to make sure that I asked my guy again, now 35, now 37.5. And I'd have to know where I was, what the pendulum was, how he dropped it. And then 10 years ago, there was a charity going on and Chaser wasn't around and they needed somebody. So Twister asked me to get up on stage and I got up on stage and it just kind of came out of me. And so I did it again. And then at a full-time job, and I got to the point where so many people were asking me, I said, well, I can't. Well, some of these bigger organizations, you know, view this as a, as an expense too, right? If you've got a good auctioneer, it's worth it to pay him because he's going to bring more money than somebody that sucks, right? So like, well, we've got a budget for this. What if we paid you? And I was like, I didn't really know that was an option. So then I started working it. And then now I have an events company where I help plan not only the auctions, but the evening, the entertainment, the run of show, help with sponsorships, you know, use my platform to try and get some sales out there for them. Even though typically these people have their own kind of, department that markets for them. And then I do the auctioneering, paddle raising and whatever else. So I'm absolutely shocked this has turned into a career. I never thought that I would have this type of job. I don't even feel like it's a job because I love people. I love being in the community and I love being able to help people raise more money than they would if I wasn't there. And, you know, that's not me saying it. Those are the referral sheets that I, you know, have on my website.
Well, what's cool is we've got a few items in here that were bought from some of his auctions. Yeah.
You're one of my clients over here.
Probably got an extra couple thousand out of me than I would have normally spent.
I can vouch. He brings more money than he should have. That's the number one thing people say after, because I've got this thing where I'm like, come on. And people are like, they're after like, I can't believe you made me spend that much. I said, I didn't make you do anything. Yeah. You voluntarily rose your hand in the air. I just coaxed you along a little bit.
Oh, that's great, man.
Well, they're always fun. I mean, it's just, I mean, with how fast you go, like, it's just, it's a hell of a talent that you have to have, or a skill you have to be able to do that.
Dude, I'm the most, like, same with my NHL. People tell me, like, Frank Cusimano, I go on his show all the time, and he was emceeing an event. And Frank's done charity events in St. Louis for 40 years, more. And I go on a show to talk about hockey. He's like, before we talk about hockey, I want to talk about Reed Lowe's auctioneering skills. He's like, watching him command the crowd and take care of this. He is the king of auctioneering. I got Frank Cusimano saying stuff that about me. So very humbled that people think I do a good job and that they know there's value in hiring me and bringing me in to help it better and, you know, be better for the community. And, you know, what a gift from God to be able to go out there and help charities raise more money and in the same way provide for my family through that without feeling like I'm taken away from the charitable organization. So it's a gift. I love it. I'm very proud of it. And I just love people, and St. Louis is a great community. So why would I not want to help it?
You got any auctions coming up?
Yep. I'm going, I just accepted the president's role for hockey players in business, this year. And, it's a little bit, what's that?
Congrats.
Thank you. It's been a little bit slower than I wanted to, cause I'm cleaning up some old business from last year, but I really want to build that network in St. Louis. You know, we're all hockey players. Why wouldn't we get together and have beers together? Why wouldn't we get together and raise money together? Why wouldn't we get together and know somebody? If there's an insurance agent out there and he's a good guy and he's a hockey guy, why would I not want to go help him out? So how can we help bring our hockey community together in St. Louis? There's 20 chapters around the United States. I started doing auctions for Shannon Lewandowski and his golf tournament about 5 years ago. And all of a sudden, Rob McKinley, who's the president of the entire thing in Cleveland, starts seeing checks come in that are like $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 more than they were the years before. And he goes to Shannon, he's like, what the hell are you doing up in St. Louis? He's like, I hired Reed Lowe. He's a former Blues player and he's an auctioneer, and he's like, he's good and he engages with people and he sets the whole thing up and I just pay him a percentage. And I don't have any guaranteed costs in it. He gets a percent, we take a percent, everything's good. He's like, oh, well, do you think you'd come out to Cleveland? So I go to Cleveland for the last two. This might be my third year going out to Cleveland. And I play in the hockey tournament that weekend and we do a gala night the Saturday night and we do that. Well, that turned into the guys in Houston were in Cleveland and they saw what I did there. And then the one guy actually worked in St. Louis for a little bit. So they're flying me down to do an auction and try and raise hockey awareness in Houston. It's the fifth largest city in the world. I know the NHL would love to be a part of that community. I just not sure they think that it's a hockey community yet, but there's a lot of people down there that love hockey. There's a lot of transplants from Canada that are down there that are hockey players. So they're bringing me in to help, you know, build a basis on hockey players and business, but it's also called Hockey Day in Houston. So there's a bunch of hockey games in the NHL that day. So we've got a gala the Friday night, and then Saturday afternoon, we're going to watch hockey and then go party, I guess, Saturday night, whatever, and fly home Sunday. Tough life I live, isn't it, guys?
Yeah, man, you got rough.
And then next weekend, I got, I'm really proud to help the Warrior Blues, Blues Warriors, I think is really what they're called. But it's a military program where we've taken the NHL, the NHL Players Association, and the alumni have taken the game of hockey and helped these veterans with it. So whether you played hockey before, you've never played hockey before, you can come in and, you know, they obviously, we do a lot of fundraising to keep the fees as low as possible for these guys. But our alumni get involved. I help coach. There's a lot of our alumni that get on the ice and help them with their practices and teach them how to play. It's fun. Some of these 45-year-old men and women never skated before in their life, and they're getting out there and they absolutely love this game. So it's even better for me to be able to see people that who'd never ever dreamed of playing hockey now, with the PTSD and the depressions and everything that comes back with our military, utilizing the game of hockey to bring that solidarity and that camaraderie back for them and the people that they're around that are like-minded and like kind they are. So that's cool. I'm going to help them with their gala awards deal on Friday. And then I'm helping the Arnold Police. I live down in Imperial Arnold area, so I'm helping them with an auction on Saturday. And then I got more, but the list is, I do it every weekend. You're busy, almost. Yeah. I did 17 auctions last November.
Oh, wow. Holy shit. That's a lot.
It was, I was my throat. I didn't have anything in December and I needed to rest my larynx. Yeah. It was I did 5 in one weekend. It was incredible.
Holy shit.
Wow.
In one day.
Well, then you might know a previous guest that we've had on, because I think he's real big into the St. Louis Warriors, Mike McKenna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, Mike's a really good dude.
He's my old neighbor. We had him on, what was that, back in like August, maybe right before. Yes. Yeah,
yeah. Him and a group just opened McAdoo's up there, too.
Oh, yeah.
Great store. One of the best liquor stores out there.
Oh, yeah.
Mike's a great guy. Another guy, St. Louis kid that made the NHL, worked hard, and I was an underdog his whole way through. And, you know, he's one of my favorites. And I'll tell you, just to give Mike the props, like, you want to talk about a guy that volunteers his time for an organization. Mike is the absolute man in that. Don Harvey is kind of the head coach of the whole thing, but Mike spends a lot of time with the goalies, teaching the goalies how to play. Mike spends a lot of time just with them, traveling on the road with them, and engaging in that community. So he's by far what I would consider like our, you know, alumni. Even though Mike didn't play for the Blues, he's still an NHL alumni and he's from St. Louis. So
I think he went to training camp with the Blues.
Did he? Yeah. He might have, yeah.
So, might have a little bit of a title.
Yeah. And listen,
he's from St. Louis.
If you played pro hockey and you live in St. Louis, we consider you to be part of our family.
Yeah.
You know, it's you don't just have to, you know, these guys understand what it's like to be in our dressing room. These guys understand what it's like to make that level of hockey. So we've got a lot of guys that are that have come back either through girlfriends or whatever. Alex Brooks, Matt Lashoff. There's a bunch of guys that aren't St. Louisans that live here today in the community that played a high level of hockey as well.
That's awesome.
Crazy. Well, Reed, you talk about failure a lot. What is a moment in your career where you hit like a rock bottom, and how did you bounce back?
I'd say there's probably two main areas, one at the beginning and one at the end. As I was telling you, that junior team, I played 2 years there, the one where I got in the fights in camp. Mm-hmm. And then I was trying out for the Western Hockey League team, my hometown, Moose Jaw, the Moose Jaw Warriors. And the coach at the time, I went in and talked to him that summer, and he's like, okay, we're going to give you exhibition games. We're going to give you a chance. I went into training camp, you know, beat everybody up. And then they cut me before the inter-squad game. I didn't even get a chance to be in the inter-squad game. So I was pissed off. And like I was telling you guys earlier, I just been cut from so many teams. I was 19 years old and I was just defeated. So I went on and back then we didn't have cell phones or pagers or nothing. So I went on a 3-day bender. My dad couldn't find me. I had been cut from the major junior team, but that team down in Minot, North Dakota, that Saskatchewan junior hockey team, was like, oh my gosh, we're getting Losey back. This is so good for us, right? And I'm like, I don't want to play hockey anymore. So I get home that Sunday morning and my dad sits down and talks with me and he's like, what are you going to do here, bud? Like, your coach is blowing up my phone. You just disappear for 3 days. Like, that's not cool. And I'm like, I'm sorry. You know, like, I just was done. You know, I had to go blow it off. And he's like, well, he's like, are you going to head back to Minot? And I said, no, I think I'm going to quit. I said, just done getting cut. He's like, well, what are you going to do? And at the time, my dad owned a real estate company. And I said, well, I was thinking I could come sell real estate for you. And he looked me right in the eyes and he said, I didn't know I was hiring. And I was like, okay, that's humbling. So my dad said, listen, son, he said, I've told you three things in your life. Be a great teammate, be coachable, and I'll work the guy across from you. I never worried about, you know, whether you scored goals, what happened. Those were the only three things that we focused on. He said, if you're done and you want to quit, that's fine. And he said, if you want to sell real estate with me, that's fine. He said, but I'm going to ask you to do me a favor before you do this. The amount of time and energy that I put into this hockey career of yours, I don't believe you're done. I think this is just a blip in the road. You go back down to Minot for 1 month. And he said, if after 30 days, you still don't have the hockey fever and you go down and you give it one more whirl and you hate the game and you're done and you want to come back and sell real estate, well, I'll teach you everything I need to know and you can take this company over. And I said, that's a fair deal. I'll do that. So I went back down to Minot. And ironically, I ended up coming back 30 days later, but it wasn't to sell real estate with my dad. I had gone down to the Minot Top Guns, which is like a tier two level, and Moose Jaw Warriors, a tier one level. And I had 10 goals and 7 assists in the first 7 games. And the Warriors were like, maybe we made a mistake here. So they called me back up. They told me that I'd be on the team for the rest of the year, assured me of that. And I said, okay, I signed a contract with them. And I ended up getting drafted by the St. Louis Blues that summer.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So, you know, it's you never know when you're ready to quit. And if there's ever somebody out there that loves you and tells you, you know, just push yourself just a little bit more. Always take them up on that offer. Because if I wouldn't have, I wouldn't have the career and the world that I have today. So my dad was instrumental in my hockey career. And then I would say the next portion of battling through, you know, at least hockey adversity was, my second last year, I broke my jaw. I got in we had the lockout and I was out of shape coming back into camp, kind of just, you know, fucked off the entire lockout year, and then didn't, you know, had some issues internally with my family and my wife and whatever else, probably some alcohol, and I wasn't in shape and I wasn't ready to play, and so the Blues put me on waivers, and it was a time when I probably would have been picked up by somebody, but every team had their team picked for like the last year, right, and had these young guys that were ready to go. So I ended up clearing waivers and I went to the minors, and then I was a healthy scratch the first week in the minors, and I'm just, oh my goodness. And then the first night I get in, I'm getting a fight with a guy named Garrett Burnett. When I'm working him for most of the fight, I switch over to left and he slips and falls and swings an uppercut and hits me in the jaw, and he snaps my jaw here completely right in half. So it was like, I looked like the Predator. Like, it was terrible. Oh. And so I got a plate and 4 screws. I was out for most of the year, played 20 games in the minor leagues on the way back in. And then, you know, I wasn't done again. I'm like, hey, I can go back. I can make the NHL again. I tried out for Chicago. Fought Derek Boogaert, had a great camp, made the team, was there for 6 games, got sent down to the minors again, and finished my year out there. And at that point in time, I'm like, you know what? I've already made the NHL one time. I don't need to do
this again. I was 31 years old. Everybody thought I was crazy for retiring, but I'm happy that I did, because it got me an opportunity to get in with some good companies that work for the next 13 years, Ritchie Brothers Auctioneers and Favic Cat. So that the breaking of the jaw was that moment where I told you guys earlier, I never really wanted to fight to begin with. And that was the beginning of the end for me. Like, is this really what I want to do? Like, I wanted, like, these guys, I went from being the chaser to the chasee. That's a different story. And I just didn't want to be a part of that anymore. I didn't want to fight anymore. I was sick of it. That broken jaw injury was probably one of the worst that I've ever had. Man, for the first 7 days, it felt like somebody was smashing me in the face with a baseball bat. Like, it was the most horrific thing I've ever been through.
Jeff, you wired shut.
Oh yeah. Wired shut, and once you get the wires off, that's when the real work begins, because they keep the hooks on there and you have elastics on there, and you basically have to, because your jaw is stagnant after 7 weeks or 8 weeks of that. I feel it's true. Look at him barely get a toothbrush in there. So just the rehab on that, everything. And then, you know, I broke my jaw, so it's not like I can go throw a bubble on and go out and just dangle around, because I wasn't there to score goals, right? Sure. So that was the beginning of the end, which wasn't bad. Again, like, there's a great story after, you know, getting cut and wanting to quit, broken jaw, gave it another kick, made the NHL again, you know, but I just knew that it was time for me to go on and do something else. I didn't have an education. I didn't have a job. And I had a little bit of money in the bank. But I just knew that you know, my purpose was something else, that there was something else out there for me. And I'm just not scared to jump into that. You know, like when I feel like it's time to go, it's time to go. I'm not going to hang around when I don't feel like not only am I not wanted, but, or I want to be there. So those are probably the two times that are the biggest that I've had to adversity and had to try and figure something else out.
Man, that broken jaw is a tough one. I have a friend of ours, former guest. He's a UFC fighter. He broke his jaw in a freak accident in practice, you know, and just kind of seeing on the outside of what he had to do, you know, recovering from that. It's whew. Money, Evan. Yeah,
I wish. You know, and then you're just gonna be kind of like, especially in the fighting aspect.
Yeah, you're gonna be gum.
Oh, yeah.
Do you still have the blade name?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, they won't come out. It's all in. It's on. It's in there. Yeah. One that they passed over top. But I don't go off and like Evan's like, do you go off in like the beepers?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's not that big, yeah. But it's stronger than it was before. So. I'm not going to find out with all the setbacks and all the things like that, the lessons that you learned. What is the one lesson from hockey that you think every kid, whether they play the sport or not, should know? Well, I think that for me, loving the game the right way is the most important. And like I've mentioned two or three times in this interview, the one thing that I've taken with me through my life is the lesson that my dad gave me about being a great teammate, being coachable, and outworking the people around you. Because those are really the things that we have control over. You know, I tell kids all the time, you don't have control over what hockey team you're on. You don't have control over whether or not you get ice time at the end of the game, or you're on the power play, or on the penalty killing, or if you're the captain, or any of that stuff. And too many times these kids will get, somebody will get to see, or they would be bitching about the coach's kid or all the different things that come to it. And it's just distraction in their mind. And so if these kids can clear their mind at a young age and train themselves to clear their mind at a young age, they're going to be able to do that easier when they move into their next portion of life. And, you know, we were talking before the show that only 7,500 guys have ever played one game or more in the NHL in the history of the sport. So you got about a 1 in 5 million chance of kids that play hockey in the world to make it. And you got a better chance of winning the lottery. And so at the end of the day, I just tell them, you know, the game of hockey is something you can love from a skating standpoint or a fan standpoint for the rest of your life. Don't be down. And even kids that are a little bit older, listen, if you make junior hockey, you're stud. Like that's, you have eclipsed something that most kids don't do. If you make it into the minor leagues, in the low-level minor leagues, wow. You make it to the East Coast in the American Hockey League, or you play over in the elite leagues in Europe or the KHL, like, again, you're one of the top players in the world. You make it to the NHL, like, this ain't so stupid, right? And so don't compare yourself to others. Really focus on where your strengths and weaknesses are, and then understand it. And one of the things that I've adapted over probably the last year of my life, the last 5 years of my life, probably 8 years of my life have been really difficult. But I'm in the best headspace I've ever been in. And one of the things that I've adapted over the last probably 8 to 10 months was I don't lose anymore. I either win or I learn. And that mindset has taken the pressure, the way that I held myself accountable in ways that really weren't fair to myself. Because if I take the losing and I take it out and I take that loss or I take that setback or whatever that is, and I try and understand and I learn from and I love that moment of my life, I'm going to start to become a strength and I'm going to start to win at that. And so too many times we put pressure on ourselves, especially as men. That's unnecessary, especially the older you get. Start getting some children, start having some setbacks, whether it be at work or a divorce or, you know, a death or whatever comes from that. And, you know, we're human creatures, and I'm a firm believer that there's a human side to us and there's a spiritual side to us. And the more I've been attached with that spiritual side, the better my life has gotten. And, you know, I'm not a religious man. And I think religion has probably hurt more people in the world than it's ever helped. But inside of that umbrella, there's a faith that you can have in there, and there's a relationship that you can have in there that is pure and it's good. And it's helped me through my toughest times, which is learning how to forgive yourself. The hardest thing that I've ever had to learn how to do is forgiving myself for being me. And you start to stack your 20s, your 30s. I'll be 49 in June. I'm 48 years old right now. You start to stack all that shame and guilt and sin and everything else that comes with it your way. And they can get heavy. That load can get real heavy. And if you don't have anywhere to go with that, it can be challenging. And so understanding how to have a mindset where you don't try and live in human emotion, right? I tell people all the time, happiness is not an emotion, it's a choice. And you can be happy if you want. And there's always going to be pockets where you're not going to be. But I don't live in the depressive state that I did years ago because it's just not worth it to me anymore. And I've changed my mindset on how I want to be and how I want to live. And so, you know, I would just encourage kids to, you know, work hard, be cool. You're going to go through a lot of shit in your life, but just make sure you focus on those three things and you should be okay.
Nikki's awesome. Yeah, it's great. So, I mean, you're raising four kids. What's the hardest part about being a father in today's world?
You know, I got a 22-year-old son and a 19-year-old son, and then I got, soon to be on March 17th, 14-year-old twins, boy, girl.
Same head.
My daughter's baby B, so she's the true baby in the family. She's a rock, though. She's a badass. And her twin brother is hilarious, Ollie. But I think the one thing that I'm learning is I'm fortunate enough to have two levels of parenthood. I have a 22-year-old and a 19-year-old that are, you know, 8 and 6 years away from the twins. Right. So I got to raise those kids. Not wrong. They're amazing children and I was extremely hard on them, but I'm just different today as a parent. I've also healed inside of myself a little bit. So I don't live at such a high rate. Like I'm a lot more relaxed and calm, than I was when I was raising my other boys. But that's still all he can push on my buttons in a really good way. And I tell people all the time, my daughter wouldn't say shit if her mouth was full of it. And all his favorite word is fuck. So gives you an understanding of who they are as human beings. But watching those two grow together and watch them be friends and watch them hate each other and watch them fight. You know, the biggest challenge again that I'll go back to when it comes to parenting is cut them some slack. Not too much. But in order to be able to cut the slack for your children, you got to cut it for yourself. We got to forgive ourselves. We've got to love ourselves. I love myself today and not in an egregious, you know, conceited type of way, but just like, it's okay, but you're going to be okay. Like, this is just life. And I tell people all the time, I'm not worried about tomorrow. I can't do anything about yesterday. I really try and live in today. Today's all I know I got for sure. And I don't even know if I've got the rest of today. So I really focus my energy on really having a great day. Because it can be a great day or it can be a fucking shit day. Again, the choice is yours. Regardless of where you're at and what you're doing, what your financial state is, there's nothing worse that I've lived in my life from an anxiety standpoint than financial stress. It's terrible, especially when, you know, for me, I've got two households to support. I've got four kids to support. And I like to have fun and do fun things and drink nice wine and all that kind of stuff. So I know that God has always provided for me, even when I had separated myself from him, he was always there. And so I just like make sure that I take a deep breath every night, every single morning I wake up, I'm thankful that I got air in my lungs and I get to kick the can down the road one more time.
Well, I know we've had conversations outside of this, but you know, what are some advice you give to parents? I know that we've talked about this, especially with parent and sports and things like that. I mean, I know, and this is something that you're pretty passionate about when we've had the conversations, what's something that you would tell parents?
Well, first off, if we're going to speak from a sporting standpoint, they're not a lottery ticket. They're a child. And we need to teach them the love of the game. Again, the three things, being a great teammate, coachability, and how to work hard. That's most important. And then don't chirp the coach behind his back. Like, you're not helping out at all, you know? You know, I think the biggest thing that as parents and as I watch and as I failed miserably at parenting, and not that I'm still not failing because, you know, failure is just success turned inside out. I think I manage it better than I ever have. Is I think sometimes when we look back at our own life, we just want so hard for our kids to do better than us, right? And sometimes that doesn't come out in the best way for that kid. When you get really upset at your kid, you're only hurting them. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to have bad days and we're not going to get excited and we're not going to over yell or do whatever it is we do. But, understanding that, you know, when we're parenting, we're basically trying to get
the wrongs out that we did. And I tell my three sons and my daughter all the time, but mostly my sons, I'm like, there's only one fucking guy on this planet that wants them to be better than you, and it's me, right? There's no other man out there. There's no other person out there that wants you to be better than them, except for me. I'm the only dude on the planet that wants that. And so how can we do that? And I sit and I talk with my kids more. When I used to be, I used to be really angry, like verbal abuse, just lose my shit. But whenever I was done that, I always felt so horrible. Like, I can't believe I allowed myself to get that angry. But I would always go over and I would sit down with them on the floor to where we were on the same level and we would talk things out. And now I rarely get myself, up to a part where I'm so angry. And we talk about it. Like, for instance, got an email yesterday from my 13-year-old where he's acting up in class. And so we start talking about it and he starts to negotiate and sell me. And I'm like, listen, stop the bullshit. Like, you can't sell me. I'm you. You're me, Percy. You're my beauty bee, man. Like, you don't bullshit me. I already know exactly what happened in class and I wasn't even there, okay? And, you know, I talked to him and I talked to him about how I am. And one of the best things I think that if you were to talk to my kids that I hope I can pass down to them is vulnerability. I'm very honest with my kids about what I've been through. I'm very honest with my kids about how I've healed. And I think that my kids appreciate the vulnerability. I tell people all the time, vulnerability is not a weakness, it's a superpower. And the more vulnerable we can become with those around us, the more swords that'll get laid down. We live in a world today that's angry. We live in a world today that wants to be right, not get it right. And I want to be everything that it's not. And, I think that the more that we can lay our swords down and love each other, because that's truly what God wants us to do. He is a God of love. And for me, having an understanding of having a relationship with God is still a work in progress for me today. But I've established a relationship with Jesus that has completely changed the way I look at life. I'm softer, I'm kinder, and it all started with me. Because if you can't be that for yourself, then you're not going to be able to be that for those that are around you. So, you know, for me, it's like, once you learn how to just take a deep breath and realize that it's just life, the harder we decide to take it, the harder it's going to be on all of us around. We're humans. We are decrepits. Yeah. You know, so it's hard work to choose happiness and to choose love and to choose kindness. It's not easy.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you say vulnerability is a superpower. What's an experience where you were truly vulnerable and it changed your life?
Well, I think that when I talk about, openly, on airwaves like this, that people are going to listen, you know, that there was a time in my life where I was an asshole. To most people around me, I was angry. I tell people I used to live at 8. The smallest thing would set me off. Typically, by the end of the day, I'd be home with my kids. My ex-wife and I had a horrific relationship. We just hated each other for the first 6 years after our divorce. There's not one person to blame more than the other. But I'll tell you guys a story. So I started it probably June of 2000. And I was like, I don't like who I was, but who do I want to be? And so again, not religious, but I'm like, I love Jesus because he's healing. He's kind. He's forgiving. He's the ultimate, right? He's love. I'm like, I'm just going to start working on being just a little more like him and a little less like me. And it took a while for me to get there. I'm finally there 5-6 years later, a little bit anyways, more than I was. But the moment that broke me, the way that I was speaking to my children, I owned a hair salon and it was a Sunday afternoon and I was up there with my kids and they were helping me. We were cleaning, doing whatever. And I hear my oldest son and this was 2000. This is November, right before Thanksgiving, 2000. So he was probably 17 years old. He's a senior in high school. Ollie was 5 or probably 7, maybe 6-7 years old. And I'm sitting downstairs and all of a sudden I hear upstairs, Connor's just losing his shit on Ollie. And I stand up and I go, that's me. I'm teaching him how to act like this still to this day. So I walk upstairs and, come around the corner and he sees me and just the look of fear in his eyes, something I'll never forget. and never hit him or nothing like that. But just, I was like, I'm a scary man and I get mad. And when you're a young kid and you see the fear and the anger in eyes and frothing at the mouth and the way that I used to act, and you see me and he's just like, oh shit. And I said, oh shit. And I go, come here. He goes, he walks over and I give him a hug and I whispered in his ear. I said, hey, I know we're not going to treat people like this anymore. And I said, I taught you how to be like this. And I said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life showing you how to not be like this. This isn't the way we treat people. This isn't the way we're going to do it. And I gave him a big hug. And he didn't really remember it until about 2.5 years later, where the Fellowship of Christian Athletes asked me to give my testimonial. And he was in the audience and I told that story. He's like, Dad, I don't really remember it like that. I'm like, well, it was the day that I realized that I had to make a change in my life. And I cried gallons. I couldn't stop. I wanted to be alone. I'd never, ever been so alone in my life. So we get to Thanksgiving, still just horrific, just terrible. And then December 7th, 2007, I was in bed, gripping a pillow, financially distressed, not knowing how I'm going to make it, not knowing how I'm going to make payments. COVID's like right there, acting like just terrible. It was ruining me. I was an auctioneer. I quit my job. I was a charitable organization auctioneer. I had no job. And it's not like I was being a little bitch and I just couldn't go get another job. Everything was shut down. I couldn't get a job. When I wanted to go get a job, I couldn't get a job. I was fucked. And so anyways, this one night, I just couldn't take it anymore. And I was like, I prayed to Jesus. I said, Jesus, I said, I've always loved you. But I don't want to live here anymore. So I appreciate it if you could either show me a sign or get rid of me. As I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm completely empty. I'm done. Long story short, a friend that worked for me at the time sent me a devotional from the Jesus Calling and a song from Casting Crowns, the Christian band, said, while you were sleeping, and if you're to listen to the words, it really relates to what I was going through. And I'm just like, whoa. And it's not like when you do that. And so right off the bat, I'm like, okay, I see it. So I start to like, okay, yeah, here we go. And then like, it's not like it gets better right off the bat. It takes work, right? Cause it's just a spirit. It's really you that you're learning how to have a relationship with. I got my vehicles repoed 3 weeks or 4 weeks later. Like the things that's kept happening bad, but the breakage had to happen for me in order to get brought back up and to build myself back up in a mindset of the things that I live today. Get it right, not be right. The coaching, like everything that I try and be, the kindness, the love that I try and give. I tell people at the end of all my auctions, the love you give is the love you live. So give a lot, right? Like I love as much as angry and as much as I hated and I was so pissed off and I argued with everybody about COVID and government and everything else. I don't live like that anymore. I live in a world of love. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, become religious or, you know, give their heart to Jesus so that they can get to heaven. That's not why I did it. You know, I want to try and find peace on earth. I want to try and find a heaven on earth that I can live in today because I'm not worried about tomorrow. Like I said, I only got today. And so, you know, from a vulnerability standpoint, like I would tell any story because if I can tell a story and somebody, one other person is out there living it that day, I want to be an avenue for them to have some happiness and some peace and some grace in their life like I'm experiencing in mine today.
Just sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, in today's world, you know, you've got the media, you got news, all this stuff coming out that's so negative and pitting one side against the other, and it can really affect people mentally. How is it that you stay the course? How is it that you maintain all of this?
Well, I try not to get on social media that much, even though I do, but I just do. I get it's a choice, right? I don't ever watch TV. Sporting events, yes, I'm all in. I don't watch the stuff. I'm not engaged. You know, I know there's what I've learned in the last couple of years, especially is there's only two things for sure that exist in this world, good and evil. And the scariest part of that is they both reside in us. Which one wins? The one you feed. So you're feeding the anger, and if you're feeding the evil, you're gonna be it, right? And then listen, Satan exists, man. That voice in your head that tells you you're not good enough, that voice in your house that says, oh, you're a failure, you're never going to be able to do this. That voice, if you want to listen to that voice, it will take you down. And it did. It took me all the way down. If you want to listen to that voice that says you are loved and you are good and you can make anything happen in your life, it's up to you. If it's meant to be, it's up to me. That's where it's at for me. We want to use excuse and blame. My mom always told me when I was a kid, be careful when you point the finger because you got three coming back at you, you know? And so I just try and, listen, is there a time where I get a little excited? Yeah, I'm human. But I really, really try and just live a little bit more in a spiritual side of myself. I'm happy all the time for the most part. And it's amazing when you start to, learn how to forgive yourself for you. It's unbelievable how easy it becomes to start forgiving people on the outside. And it's not a big deal, right? You're just like, but oh, you're an asshole. Did I get, you'll get over. You know, like, I don't need to fight with you. I don't need to argue back with you. This is no big deal, right? And typically when the vulnerability and the kindness comes out and somebody's being a donkey to you and you give love back, you watch them drop a sword like that. It's really hard to be an asshole to somebody that's being nice to you. Even when you continually be an asshole, you know what I mean? My road rage isn't as bad as it used to be. There's a lot of good things that have come out of it. And, it's all about a feeling and it's all about, it all starts with love. And, you know, I'm in a couple Bible studies and I love the Bible because it's a treasure map of one's own heart. All the stories and everything that are in it, all the people that want to talk about yay, nay, and whatever else. But, one of the things I tell people all the time is when people talk about the word of God, to me, the word of God is one, it's singular and it's just log, it blankets everything. And so a lot of times people forget that. And so that's why I always come back. For me, it's like, whenever I have that moment, my trigger is always like, are you loving the situation right now? Are you giving love to everything that's going on? And if you're not, then get your mind right. I think, tell you another thing that's super important, and I've been really practicing this for about a year and a half, and that's gratitude. Mm-hmm. Gratitude is probably one of the missing components in our world today, out of anything. And I'm on a line where there's probably 30 of us ex hockey players that have all suffered with depression and mental toughness and all the things that we've had to go through in our lives. Most of us are tough guys. And guys are like, there's some bad moments out there. We've lost some guys to suicide. And our buddy Chuck Thoss, he's a goalie. He's the one that got it all started up. And now there's like 40 of us that come on every other Wednesday. Sometimes you can make it, sometimes you can't, but the group's about 40. And we have this guy in there that literally got a degree from Oxford in gratitude. And so he's talking to us about gratitude. He said, listen, whenever something bad happens in your day, just stop yourself for a couple minutes and think of three things that you're grateful for. And your mind immediately turns into what you have, not what you don't have. And so I would say one of them, just to answer your question, after all that windiness that I just passed, gratitude's probably, you know, that self-forgiveness, self-love, and gratitude. Like, those are three things that I practice every single day of my life. And, it just changes the way that I am. It changes who I am. People seem to like me better. So, you know, I like me better. I like it because I feel good inside and I wake up in the morning knowing that, you know, it's just crazy because, I woke up Monday morning and I'm just like, oh, 3 o'clock in the morning, just like anxiety through the roof. I'm just like, hey, you don't have to have this. Well, in the head of my pillow. I'm like, Holy Spirit, come across me. I don't know. I do not want to live in this. Take this fear and this anxiety and dispel it. Get rid of it. And it's crazy. Like, I truly call it on. I truly say, get rid of me. Get it out of me. I don't want you. And literally, I'll be sleeping in 30 seconds where I'd be up for 2 hours before. I just, if you don't have to accept it, you do not have to accept it. We can be filled with love. And if every single person tried to get it right in this world rather than be right, we have such a wonderful place to live. It's not even funny.
Yeah, absolutely. Gratitude's such a powerful, which is such a powerful thing. I mean, I kind of have this habit of mine that I do every day. I have a little sticky note on my mirror, you know, and I look at it every night when I'm brushing my teeth, and it just says, what went well today?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, it just kind of helps me run through the day, and I just think about all the good shit that happened. There could have been a bunch of really bad things that happened. Deals could have fallen apart, could have gotten into a fight with somebody, or get, you know, argument with whoever. But, you know, I'm always, you know, that just reminds me every day, like, all right, what today do I have to be thankful for? And I have so much to be thankful for, and it always gets me, like, it's such like a good mindset before you go to bed.
Such a good mindset. And you get to see when you brush teeth in the morning too.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I brush twice. But,
at least. I suggle the core bad better. I'm a definitely every morning guy. Nobody wants to walk around with that narrative breath. No. Found my 13-year-old. I'm like, dude, nobody wants to smell your shit breath. Yeah. You need to do first. But I tell you, like, just to piggyback on that a little bit, what I started seeing happen and what you might start seeing happen is when you start thinking about what good happened, what's going to happen is those things will creep into your head that weren't good, but you'll start to look at, oh, how could I make that better? One thing that I do anytime I get into some level of controversy, conflict, stuff like that, before I go anywhere, what could I have done differently in this situation to make it not happen? Before I go blaming everybody else around me, what could I have done differently? Not losing, learning them.
Yeah.
I'm learning. What could I have done differently? Now I'm going to get in that situation again in 2 weeks, and I'm going to remember it because I asked myself an honest question, and I was just honest with myself. Stop bullshitting myself that things were that they really weren't, right? And so that's another thing that I really try and do is just make sure that I'm holding myself to the highest standard that I can of integrity and love. Before I go to somebody else. And then after, be like, okay, well, this is what I could have done better. What are your feelings? Now I don't have to tell them. They're going to tell me because I've already laid the sword down and was vulnerable and said, listen, this is where I think I fucked up. This is where I wish I could have done a little bit better. How are you feeling? That guy's not going to come back over me and reiterate all the shit I just called myself out on, is he? Or he's a major dick and I'm going to get up and walk out and never talk to him again. Right.
I mean, I do something similar to that. It was, I think it was Enzo that told us, he's like, write the three memories now from the day.
Mm, yeah.
And three things that you remember that were really good. So I've been doing that at the end of every day, just writing three things that I remember about the day, that I liked about the day, that was good about the day. And then I can always go back and be like, oh, yeah, I remember, like, now, instead of like trying to remember myself, it's all written down. I can just go back to that day or like look back to this journal that I've got at home. And it's like, hey, this would these, you know, and now it's helping me remember things like the other day when the boys and I were up at the church playing baseball. And, you know, Connor and Oliver were really struggling, and I'll never forget this. And I was like, guys, let's change the mindset. Let's not get upset. You're not going to hit every one. But just when you step up to the plate, just know in your mind that you're going to hit the shit out of the ball. So now every time they step up to the plate, they're literally saying, I'm going to hit the shit out of the ball.
5 and 6 years old, and I was just like,
your boys are Connor and Oliver.
Yeah.
How ironic. Right? I've got Connor and Oliver too. That's hilarious.
Crazy.
So now every time I'm like, guys, say it in your head. Hey? Connor, you're ready to start Little League. Like, you can't walk up to the plate. Hey? I say, I'm going to hit the shit out of the ball.
Says the Reggie, the pitcher, I'm going to hit the shit.
So yeah, it's awesome. And, but wow.
Well, how do you define success?
Oh, yeah, man.
That's a tough question, I know.
You know, there's, depending on which read we're going to ask, you know, for me today, I define success with kindness. Just loving. I know that I'm successful if I just continue to love the world and be good to the world and, you could be a little more like Jesus and less like me, you know? Another word that I use a lot is I live in a surrenderous land. You know, Jesus died on the cross for us every day. He did that so that we wouldn't have to worry. And, sometimes it's hard to come to the table and accept that and receive that. But the more that I surrender to the life that is supposed to be out in front of me, the less I have to look down for, right? Now it's not me making a decision and me this and me that and da, 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 da. It's like, here I am. I'm going to put myself where I should have been and you shouldn't have been. And I'm going to allow the world to come out in front of me. And I'm going to accept whatever human would think is good, bad, or ugly that comes into my day.
I'm going to accept it. I've already accepted it. So if I've already accepted it, it's really tough for me to get down on something because it's what's supposed to be there. Good, the bad, and the ugly. And typically with my mindset being no lose, win or learn, I'm going to be enjoying what's out in front of me. I've ever since I've changed the way that I looked at things a couple of years ago, gratitude, surrender, faith, living in grace, my world has gotten better. God brought me an amazing woman. She lost her husband a year and a half ago. I know for sure that there's a higher power that brought us together. I know that I was brought in her life so that I could help protect her. Loving husband, they've been together 31 years, married 26 years, and you know, wonderful, wonderful kids. My relationship with my kids is stronger today than it's ever been. I was telling another little story. I was sitting at the table, and this was probably 3 years ago, and I listened to a lot of Christian music. Brandon Lake's probably my favorite. If you guys haven't listened to Brandon Lake, man, he's off the charts. It's so good. And so we're sitting at the table, and Ollie's like, the twins, Ava's on one side, Ollie's on the other, and Ollie's like, I like this song, I like that song, and Ava's quiet. She doesn't talk a lot. And she's like, well, Daddy, I love Jesus too. I'm like, oh, Dave, I'm like, he's so happy about that. And she's like, well, actually, I kind of don't really understand it. She's like, I'm just happy for what he's done to you. That's awesome. I'm like, oh,
melt your heart. Yeah.
You know, so I know that my kids have watched me change. I know that I've been forgiven for me, from them, and from the heavens. And that's just a good feeling to know that the more that I walk in the world that I'm walking in, it's what's supposed to happen. And I think so many times as humans, we want to control our life. Then we want to, you know, like Carrie Underwood says, Jesus, take the wheel. And I, you know, Corey all the time, like it was a year and a half ago when I was just working with him, and he's like, I'm like, dude, you're going to have to let Jesus take the wheel. He's like, he can have the wheel, but he's going to be sitting on my knee and I got the gas pedal. I'm like, that's how it works, man. You can't get those. It's like, Zach Williams. You should listen to him too. He's got a song called To the Table, and he basically is in a prison singing to a bunch of prisoners. And he's like, if you just bring, there's a table, imagine a table as far as the eyes can see, and every chair has a name on it. And your name's there, and all you got to do is bring all your junk and all your worries and all your problems, lay them on that tail, lay that stuff at the foot of the cross, surrender it, let it go. Don't have to carry it with you. Don't have to own it. It will work itself out without you being a complete basket case. And so I think what is success and what, you know, that is it for me. The more that I can live and allow the world to come to me and accept it and receive it and know that it's going to be good, the more it is. And it's just beautiful when you allow it to unfold in front of you and allow the universe to work.
Wow. Yeah, that's beautiful, Mir. Well, we want to be mindful of your time. I know you got somewhere to be. This has been awesome having you on. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. But before we get out of here,
we always hit them with one last question. We call it the tombstone game.
Okay.
Here lies Reed. What's it say, Reed Tombstone?
Reed loved everyone more than humanly possible.
Perfect.
It's beautiful.
It's awesome.
Well, thank you. Thanks again, man. I really appreciated your time here today. This is always. So, well, thank you guys for tuning into the show. Please click that subscribe button if you haven't yet. That would help us out a ton. Click that like button as well. Comment what you thought below, and we will see you next time.